The MF set was notoriously unreliable because of atmospheric noise and dead spots, as well as circuit malfunctions that occurred frequently in the warm, moist, salty atmosphere. Consequently, pilots flying from carriers often found themselves without long-range communications. What mistakes in navigation Dixon made that day may never be known. Plane 66 encountered another plane from the squadron when well out on its search leg, and one of them must have been out of its sector. Dixon, however, did not become concerned for some time afterward, even taking time to make practice bombing runs on a smoke float. En route to the carrier, Aldrich, the radio man, heard Japanese traffic on the MF radio and pulled out his transmitter plug to indicate to the pilot that he was observing radio silence on that channel. When he did not sight the carrier as expected, Dixon called on his short-range VHF radio, but he received no answer, nor any signal from the YE. Examining the matter after nearly 50 years, one must conclude that some errors in navigation probably occurred on the outbound leg, causing 66 to wander into another sector. As both the VHF voice and the YE homing beacon had been working earlier in the flight, it is most likely that the lost plane was more than 50 miles from the carrier and simply out of VHF range when Dixon attempted to establish contact during his return. With fuel running low, Dixon decided to ditch while he still had power and daylight, and he reviewed with his crew what equipment to carry on leaving the plane. Then he made what all three men later described as a beautiful power stall landing. When the plane came to rest, the three men quickly passed the raft to Dixon, who had climbed out onto the wing. He encountered some difficulty with a malfunctioning inflation valve, and before he could inflate the raft, the plane suddenly sank beneath him, carrying most of the survival gear down with it. The loss is understandable. Neither backseat crewman was a proficient swimmer. Though they had carried out their abandoned ship promptly, the three were now in the water with no equipment other than the raft and life vests. When improved survival gear was later developed, much of it would be stowed within the raft to ensure it did not go down with the plane. But the three men of 66 would have to get by with what little they had salvaged. They realized the inadequacy of their supplies the very first morning, when a search plane flew close by and the survivors had no means of signaling it. The lack of a more thorough search is not remarkable. The task force had a far more compelling mission than looking for survivors of one downed plane and did not wait in the area. Although humanitarians may disapprove, combat commanders nearly always assign destruction of the enemy a higher priority than rescue of survivors when the two tasks conflict. And Dixon accepted this reality early on. Furthermore, one of the search planes ditched on the morning of the 17th, having run out of fuel, and Task Force 8 had to suspend flying in the afternoon to refuel its ships. Finding themselves in a life raft, in an empty ocean, with very little gear, the men did not know where they were, nor what their prospects of survival were. The plane had gone down just south of the equator, some 1,900 miles southwest of Hawaii. So their position was about 600 miles southeast of Tarawa, and the Japanese occupied Gilbert and Marshall Islands, but 700 miles northwest of American Samoa, from which a long chain of hundreds of islands, still in Allied hands, stretched 1,500 miles south and west through Fiji and New Caledonia. Furthermore, the survivors knew that Japanese submarines were operating in the area. Dixon, the leader and only qualified navigator of the three, determined to try and reach one of the American atolls. Though he attempted to guide the raft to the southwest, it finally landed on Pukapuka, a New Zealand-governed atoll in the Danger Islands, 346 miles northeast of Samoa and 423 miles from the ditching point on the 19th of February. To get to Pukapuka, however, the raft had meandered on various courses for an estimated 1,200 miles. Though the men's effort to navigate their craft had only a minor effect on the raft's movements, those efforts did afford the castaways some feeling of controlling their destiny and help to sustain morale. The story of the voyage, with few resources except courage and indomitable human spirit, is not only inspiring reading, but a tribute to the human species and its will to survive. The miraculous escapes, especially the passage over a killer reef and the reaching of safety only a day ahead of a typhoon, also suggests that someone was looking over them. John M. Waters, Captain, United States Coast Guard, retired. Preface by Robert Trumbull. Bomber pilot Harold Dixon was a man that Bly would fancy. Time, March 23, 1942. Captain Bly would indeed have fancied Dixon. The famous Englishman, with his 17 men from the mutinied Bounty, accomplished a classic of the sea that men will never weary of telling. But for his 48-day voyage from Tofua in the South Pacific to Timor, Netherlands East Indies, a distance of 3,618 miles, he had a 23-foot boat. Dixon, Pastula, and Aldrich, to cover 1,000 miles in 34 days, had an inflated rubber raft 8 feet by 4 feet overall. Captain Bly had 32 pounds of pork, 150 pounds of bread, 28 gallons of water, 6 quarts of rum, 6 bottles of wine, a quadrant, a compass, and canvas. Dixon and his two companions had a pocket knife, a pair of pliers, an automatic pistol that soon became useless from corrosion, and a length of line. They had no food, no water, no instruments, no means of controlling their tiny fabric boat. Dixon devised a series of ingenious makeshifts that enabled him to control his craft and chart his course, but the raft tipped over so easily in the heavy Pacific swells that in the end he and his two young sailors had nothing, not even a shred of clothing to protect them from the equatorial sun. Before they lost their clothes, they were able to catch drinking water by soaking their rags when it rained and wringing them into an oar pocket. They pulled their food from the air and the sea. Very little food, that was. Not enough, as Dixon said, to make them one good meal. It was no wonder, then, that they were given up for dead. But Dixon sailed that raft, made it go where he wanted it to go, and brought his men through. When I saw them for the first time at Pearl Harbor, they looked like any three men of our Navy, such as I might meet on Waikiki Beach, or looking for an afternoon's amusement on Hotel Street. That was the wonder of the story to me. They were just three men who happened to have been assigned to take up a scout bomber from a carrier prowling the far South Pacific. When they got into that plane, they barely knew each other by sight. They could have been any chief petty officer, any two sailors of their ratings. But they were men like these. Dixon, the spokesman for the trio, came to my house at Waikiki for a weekend, and we talked the best part of a night and a day. This book is the result. I have tried to tell the story much as Dixon told it to me. Robert Trumbull, Honolulu. Chapter 1. The plane struck the surface of the sea with a sound like the slap of a giant hand on the water. A great splash of water instantly covered the glass in front of me, momentarily shutting out my vision. 2 sharp bumps, and the plane settled quietly back on the long, slow swells. I had made a good landing. As I rose from my seat in quick concern for Jean, Tony, the raft, and a multitude of things that competed for my attention in this crowded moment, I was conscious that the plane was bobbing gently up and down, but that at any second a wave might pull a wing and we'd be gone. The sea that had looked so flat and solid from the air was now a reaching, greedy thing that shook its prey before devouring it. I knew that our small 3-man scout bomber would not float long. It is no great trick to set a land plane down on water, but these heavily armored war jobs are not intended to float. I had no idea of staying with it very long. I jumped as quickly as I could onto the left wing to receive the raft from Tony Pastula, my bomber, and he was right there to hand it to me without an instant's delay. Gene Aldrich, my radio man and gunner, was raising himself from the rear cockpit and was busy with his gear. I was already trying to open the raft's gas valve, which seemed to stick. Suddenly, there was no airplane. The next thing I knew, I was hanging in my life jacket, kicking the water. The sinking of that plane was like a magician's trick. It was there, and then it was gone, and there was nothing left in our big, wet, darkening world but the three of us and a piece of rubber that was not yet a raft. Of course, the plane took with it everything the two boys in their well-disciplined haste had pulled together from the emergency stores and equipment. I was soon to discover that what fight we were to make for our lives must depend upon the junk in our pockets. Tools attached to the raft, which was so negligible in value as to be almost frivolous, and the uses we could make of the clothes upon our backs. All these things were to stand us well until they were wrested from our grasp, one by one, by the great unseeable enemy we fought. And then our only weapon was the mind, until this too began to go in the particular corrosion to which it is susceptible.